and welcome to episode one of the Replacement Level Podcast. I'm Ross Carey. Thanks for listening. Thrilled to be joined right now by Bob Ryan. Bob is a longtime columnist for the Boston Globe. He's been honored by the Basketball Hall of Fame and is a voting member of both the basketball and baseball halls. He's also a frequent contributor to the Sports Reporters and PTI. Bob, thanks so much for joining the podcast today.
Hey, Ross. Good to be with you.
Bob, let's start at the beginning, I guess. Tell me what initially attracted you to sports in the first place.
I don't remember not being attracted to sports. I grew up in a sports-oriented household. Everything in our house revolved around going to games. My father was involved in sports in various capacities, both in public relations and marketing and so forth, in my hometown of Trenton, New Jersey. And I don't ever remember when it wasn't the way we lived. We all lived. The whole calendar was around going to games. And so, and concurrent with that, I loved to read and I had an affinity for the written word. So you put the two things together. I played as long as I could. I read, always read, and was interested in that idea of it. And I had a very good exposure to sports. Also, I grew up in a very well-located city in New Jersey. Trenton, New Jersey in the 50s had access to television that was denied anybody else in America. We had the best deal there was in the country in that we got every channel on the dial, from New York and Philadelphia. Most municipalities were lucky if they had the three channels, and we had everything literally from 2 to 13. So saw baseball games. I saw the Dodgers and the Giants and the Yankees and the Phillies in a point when most people were lucky to get the game of the week, and that was it. So all that stuff together, and it was kind of a natural fit.
You started with the Globe, the Boston Globe, in 1969. At that point, you must have had expectations as to what being a professional sports journalist were going to be, what that life would entail.
No,
what part
no
of the
idea.
Job met your expectations, and what part of the job did you never anticipate?
I don't have any idea about what the scope of it is, and it was going to change anyway, but you just want to have a job, and you know it involves covering something in writing, and that's the extent of it. That was it. I mean, it was to take it piece time, you know, piecemeal, take it circumstance by circumstance, and you don't have any grandiose vision. I didn't imagine traveling as much. I didn't imagine ever covering the Olympics. I didn't imagine all the things that spun off this, and of course no one in 1969 was thinking about having a radio and TV career concurrent with your writing career. You wrote, or you went into radio, or you went into television. You didn't combine them.
One of the things that's changed with journalism, not just with sports journalism, but with journalism across the board, is time. There used to be time for reporters to have weeks, maybe even months, to try and build a story. But now everything gets out so quick. And that's partly a good thing, that information gets out quicker. But it's also, it creates sloppy reporting sometimes as well. How do you feel like new media, starting with radio and television and the internet, have changed journalism?
There was always competition, and competition's vital and necessary among journalistic entities, with newspapers versus newspapers, TV versus TV, radio versus radio. And you're right, there was an acknowledgement that you did have more time to develop, but there was always a scoop mentality that goes back, certainly in American journalism, to the turn of the century. The Hearst network empire was born out of, and many of the legendary journalistic conglomerations of the late 19th and early 20th centuries were extremely competitive, and getting it first was essential in their mind. So that was always the case. Now, though, getting it first then meant you would have it on the doorstep the next morning. Now, because of the instantaneous nature of everything starting with tweeting, the getting it first means getting it at first and then getting it out absolutely, literally, immediately. So you can see that the inherent danger of all this, and it is dangerous, and it's not healthy, and there's really very little good about it to be said, because too often things start to take on a life of their own way too prematurely, and it's utter madness at times, and no one's got a handle on this thing yet, or will fess up to the danger of it. I don't think so. The climate, I mean, that's only one small part of the story about how the whole climate of coverage of not just sports, but obviously of politics, particularly, and I guess entertainment too, have changed. But sports I can speak to, and it has changed. And in that regard, and it's not going back, by the way. it's not going back. So that's just, you have to live with it or move on. And I'm happy that at this stage of my career, I can step away and let somebody else deal with it.
You mentioned sort of the evolving nature as to how to sports entertainment have sort of been promoted a little bit and covered as well. And there seems to be like an interesting shift that really started in the 80s when you think about the marketing and the mass marketing of sports, not just towards sports fans and diehard sports fans, but to casual fans. But because of that, we've seen a huge shift in how sports are covered and promoted. And this really started in the 80s when you had national organizations like ESPN and you had national media outlets. You had the rise of television, sports on constantly, and sports radio. And this, to me, is an interesting shift in how sports are viewed and how baseball, in particular, is still viewed today. When you look at the 80s of the NBA, which you know very well, not only did you have Magic and Bird and Jordan, but you also had a host of other superstars that when a ton of attention started coming to sports, the NBA was at its best. And the same thing was true with the NHL. The NHL had Gretzky and Lemieux and those great Oiler teams and those great teams, and the NHL was at one of its peaks. Same thing with football, as football had those great 49ers teams and a huge change with how the game was played with the West Coast offense. And you had Joe Montana and Marino and all the great players of the 80s. While baseball obviously had some great players of the 80s, the 80s as a whole seemed like a down decade. And I wonder if baseball still feels the price for having a down decade right when sports were starting to explode.
The thing about baseball is that whatever your generalization you make about baseball, and they are made over various decades, baseball has an astonishing resiliency. I'm not sure exactly how to answer the question, but I just want to point out something. There's a perception. Obviously, football has become the number one national sport. There isn't any question about it. Anybody would be a fool to argue otherwise. But baseball is doing very nicely, and the standards are so vastly different now. And what was widely and now is looked back upon as a sort of a golden era, both in terms of the percentage of people who seem to follow baseball and the nature of the players, which what I would say post-World War II until say 1970, when and you're talking about an era that included the Feller, DiMaggio, Williams, Musial, and then later on Aaron Mays, Mantle, Frank Robinson, Sandy Koufax, Bob Gibson, etc. People look back with great fondness on that era. A great attendance was 1 million. 2 was unimaginable. And the world seemed fine. Everybody was fine with that. And people understood that the ballpark didn't have to be full every night to have a viable franchise. And now everybody budgets, you know, any good for 2.5. The team that only draws 1.6 million is considered to be deficient. But people are coming to the ballpark, and there's always this talk about the young people that follow. But, well, I don't know. Somebody's going to the park. You go to the park and you see young kids. So I'm saying baseball is an astonishing resilient. There is something inherent about nature of the game that has allowed it to overcome the modern, I don't know what the word is, the modern evolution of technology and media. When it's not the best TV game, football is a much better TV game, and basketball is a better TV game, but it survives. So, I mean, I just be careful, I say to anybody, about these generalizations about the demise of or the decline of baseball. It survives, and there's real good reasons why football has prospered as opposed to baseball, which is entirely other topic. Baseball now, we're deep into the 21st century, it's trying to adjust. It's trying to expand with expanded playoffs, and the purists don't like it. And the obvious reason is to keep more people interested in September and even have another team involved in October, although for a one-game playoff, I think it's absurd, and that's another matter.
Well, Bob, you mentioned the baseball purists, which, to be honest, as someone that's 33 years old, have always driven me crazy. Because baseball, more than any other sport, clings to the past. There are still writers that can't get over the DH. It's been around for 40 years. There are still writers that opine about how terrible interleague play is, but look at all the attendance that happened this weekend. Yankees and Mets played this weekend, and they set Citi Field set their attendance record on Saturday, then they broke it again on Sunday. Fans like interleague play. Fans like the DH. But baseball, and in particular the people who cover baseball, cling to the past. Look at your consensus team. Your consensus all-time team still has Gehrig, Hornsby, Wagner. It still has Walter Johnson as your pitcher. Do we really believe that every great player in the history of the game was born in the late 1800s?
Well, let's see. Since I started and since I grew up with this, we've got a new third baseman. We have a new catcher, for sure. Bench is the catcher. Schmidt's the third baseman. Nobody's arguing this. Out with Mickey Cochran and out with Pie Trainer. That was the consensus third baseman. The shortstop, Wagner, still gets votes, and he retired in 1917. But I think that you got arguments for Ripken and for Ozzy, very strong. Second base is now a great. A lot of people feel Joe Morgan is the best second baseman of all time, I wouldn't argue that at all. So all I'm getting at is that, for the outfield, if only Bonds were clean, we wouldn't have any problem throwing him into the discussion. But he is another time. All I'm saying is, that's always a fun part of the discussion. I think baseball, I wouldn't call it clinging to the past. The marriage with the past is the huge advantage baseball has over everybody else. You're a modern pro football fan. They never heard of Tuffy Lehman's. They barely know who Sammy Ball was. They never heard of Bob Waterfield. They never heard of Hurry and Hugh McElhaney, Pistol Pete Pijos for the league in reception several times. But baseball fans know their history. So, football better address this, frankly. But anyway, the DH, yes, I still feel it's a better game in the National League. So I don't want the DH. And the idea that the big problem lost with baseball is not that there is a DH or there isn't a DH. It's that one World League has it and the other one doesn't. And that's the idiocy. And that's when we get into the stupid nonsense of interleague play, deciding what ballpark's going to have a DH. And then we get to the postseason where it's even crazier. And then that's the shame of baseball. Not that there is a DH or that there isn't, but that they don't have a unanimity of opinion one way or the other, which I think is obviously logical. And then the interleague schedule, there is no question that interleague play is successful in some underlying areas and irrelevant in most underlying areas, and that it has diluted and the All-Star game is not, because of interleague play, has nowhere near the cachet it once had, and the postseason has been damaged by interleague play too. I think interleague play is a mistake, and just because the Yankees and Mets draw, go tell me about how the Pirates and the A's draw. The Royals draw for anybody. Anyway, we got off on the topic, on the tangent there. But in general terms, I'm going to support. You're right about that. Baseball people tend to be very defensive, and there ought to be certain sort of self-examination. I'm just curiously, but I've never thought about it a whole lot until now. But yeah, football has done a miserable job of marrying itself to its rather glorious past, whereas baseball does this tremendous job in that regard. And that's also, by the way, you can say what you want about baseball, but this one Hall of Fame and all the others are in second place. And nobody goes around arguing who should be in the Football Hall of Fame or the Basketball Hall of Fame or the Hockey Hall of Fame or anything else. It's the Baseball Hall of Fame, which is the number one conversational topic in American sports. Could be discussed every single day, 365 days a year, in a way that the other sports can't even begin to touch.
That's absolutely right, and we're going to start talking about that right about now. You mentioned Barry Bonds a little bit earlier. Barry Bonds, of course, has become the figurehead of the era that I think is unfairly being labeled
and
as
quite
the
head,
steroid
I might
era.
Add.
Yeah, quite the head, quite the shoes as well, I'm sure. But before we get into the specifics about Bonds and the HOF voting process itself, I want to talk about how PEDs were covered, or not covered, when the whole situation was unfolding. Tell me about the first time you heard about a baseball player using steroids.
Don't remember. Not trying to think. I don't know. We were, let's go back before the steroids. Let's go to the Greeny era. we're aware of amphetamines, aware of this of a phenomenon known as greenies, and it was just it was kind of like a joke, more or less. Nobody knew. I mean, nobody. We didn't know. I don't know. Maybe some other writers know. I don't know how far back you have to go where this stuff is introduced into baseball. You know, I don't know whether it was 40s, 50s, 60s. I don't know. But there's just nobody paying attention to it. It was not an issue. And I'm trying to think. It's a great question. When did steroids start? I don't know. Frankly, I really don't know exactly. But now we have it. You know, we know that somewhere. And certainly by the 80s they're around, and that's as far as back, but I can't pinpoint. But you know, as we know, but it wasn't just steroids. You remember, the first problem was baseball. We're talking about the teams that went, the guys that went down with coke. Before we got to the steroids, we're talking about the coke usage and the guys who were brought down by that.
And some of those players are in the Hall of Fame. Paul Molitor was one
dated.
Of those guys.
Yeah, including the great Paul Molitor. Yeah, it's always. Well, I got a handy hint for the bad guys, which is. Confession works wonders. They'd be surprised. It's adamantly, proclaiming obvious guilt, obvious, when they're not guilt, when not innocent. Anyway, yes, they are. We're going to obviously get to the overall topic of how difficult it is to, adjudicate all this.
Yeah, and it's tough to sort of measure when exactly they came into the game. I remember Jim Haslett, the coach for the Steelers, he mentioned that the great Steelers football teams were using steroids in the 70s, which, of course, God forbid any player from the Reds of the 70s or the Pirates team of the 70s said that. It would be on the national news. It'd be congressional hearings. Someone says that in baseball, people go crazy. And someone says it in football, that one of the best teams ever were using steroids. They're just like,
nah. And do you know why?
Why's that?
Because people... Football players are viewed like robots, creatures from outer space anyway, and especially the linemen. Nobody, I'll say this. Just show me a 350-pounder, and I'll show you guys your weight 270. I mean, I've always said that. People just let them go do what they want to do. It doesn't bother, they're not hitting the baseball. They're not doing it's not anything overt that people can see the reaction, the result of. They can't see the consequence of that. When we're talking about linemen doing roids in football or linebackers and all that, it's just, they're all crazy anyway, kind of thing. I think that's half of it. And they are too, to play that game at that level. They are all crazy. And to some honest to God degree, they're almost certifiably insane to want to play professional football. So, you just humor them and let them go do what they want to do, and who really cares? They're not hurting anybody but themselves. That's the kind of thing we look at, each other. They're not messing around with the record book, which in baseball is sacrosanct. I'm being a little bit flippant, but not much.
Well, and I know what you're saying, and no one knows any NFL records. No one knows how many yards that Barry Sanders rushed for, if that's even the record anymore, if it's O.J. Simpson, whatever it is. No one knows any of the records. But it's interesting because football is a sport where speed and strength directly affect every game and every play. That's all the combine is. The NFL combine, they just measure speed and strength, how high you can jump, how much weight you can lift, how fast you can run. That's all it is. Every year, players who do these things better than expected move up in the draft, and players who do it worse, move down. And steroids directly affect those things. They don't directly affect your ability to hit a ball.
Yeah, true. And of course, all this has nothing to do with can they play football, but sooner, it's just that there's nothing more laughable than the NBA NFL combine when it comes down to trying to find out who can really play football. I mean, it's just a self-perpetuating exercise. I mean, it's just, you're right. And yep, it's a hard thing to explain, but people, the bottom line is, people don't care. They don't care if their football players are roided up, if it gives them better collisions. They care. Baseball players, baseball fans of at least moderate sophistication care very much about the nature of how their game was played. I don't think football cares care very much about the nature of the way their game is played, except that now they're forced to be confronted. Everybody's been forced to confront the concussion issue. And that's the first time in the history of the game that the actual health and safety of players has seemed to grab the attention of people, because other than that, you just take it for granted. You're going to play, you're going to get hurt, the guy's going to have a short career, and you throw in the next guy. And that's football. And no other sport looks at it that way, as cavalierly and as routinely as football. But that's the nature of the game.
Right, and it's changing for the better as the league starts to protect concussions.
Yeah, it is, and yet it's against the it's against the general nature of the people who run it, i.e. the coaches.
That's right.
And the players. You know, it's got to start young. You know, you gotta start so that these players aren't ingrained at age 12. This is the way you play the game. No, there's another way to play the game. You know, you don't have to take the guy. You know, bring him down is all you want to do. Not knock him into next Thursday. And until we get away from that, then football will always be dangerous. I mean, excessively dangerous.
Moving back to the PED issue, we'll talk about whether or not these players should be in the Hall of Fame or not in a moment, but regardless of their status as Hall of Famers or not Hall of Famers, given the scope of use in baseball at the time, from whatever, the mid-80s to the early aughts, whatever we want to call that decade, given the scope of how many players were using, the hundreds of players that were using, players were getting referred to use drugs, or they were recommended to use PEDs by team trainers and team doctors, by coaches. Would you say the story was missed as a whole in terms of how it was covered by the BBWAA?
Sure. I was around. And you didn't. I mean, let's go right to 1998. Let's go right to the Maguire-Sosa home run battle that is so widely regarded as at the time as shedding a glorious, wonderful, shining light on baseball. 4 years after the shutdown of the sport, which was a low point in the 20th century. Low point post Black Sox, the lowest point in baseball post Black Sox of 1919 was the shutdown of the postseason of 1994. And now 3 years later, we've got Maguire and Sosa in this glorious race to take Roger Maris out of the record books. And I was there, like as were many, on the weekend, in the Labor Day weekend in St. Louis, when it all came to a head and Maguire got the record equaled and broken. And it was... And the Cubs were there, and Sosa, and they're getting along famously, and it's back slapping, and then everybody's into it. And even Jack McKeon, the manager of the Reds, who always walked Maguire routinely, announced, "I'm not going to walk him this weekend." I mean, he was into this to get the record broken. And I'm sitting up there, and I'm looking at Maguire one day on the podium on a table, and said, "My boy, what a big guy! Look at those arms, you know." That's it. I'm telling you right now, the idea of artificial enhancement, when we were told that he was just a workout warrior, didn't come into my head. And it didn't come into the head of too many other people either at the time, or else somebody would have said something. No, we were caught blindsided, loving the euphoria of the good news story. And if anybody, and if there were a lot of people who were thinking the negative thoughts, they kept them to themselves. And I'm talking about, people can go think of whatever they want about us, but I'm happily plead guilty to stupidity and ignorance, and as opposed to any kind of malfeasance here. No, I never occurred to me that was the reason. I was too caught up in what was at the time. I came away from that saying this is the best non-event story I've ever covered. In other words, the best non-game oriented story that I had ever covered. The most fun and the best good feeling you walked out of there with was at that weekend in St. Louis. And of course, we all know now it was a fraud, and we were misled, and you know, that's the shame of it. Yes.
See, Bob, I really object to the term of it being a fraud. How many players, roughly, do you think were using steroids in 1998?
I have no idea. I don't know.
Do you think 30% is a reasonable number?
No, I don't. I don't think so.
Significantly more or less?
Not less. Less. I think less. But I just say, I don't know. In 1998, I don't know. This is the most. I hate this topic. I despise this topic. I every second we start, we dwell on this topic is a waste of good time, in my opinion. It's such an unbelievably awful topic. It just distorts everything. You know. No, I know. I don't know how many. What percentage did? No, I don't know. I do not know. I don't. I read Canseco's viewpoint. You know, he looks like he was more right than he was wrong.
Canseco has proven to be truthful sometimes, but he's proven also that his opinion can be bought. There's a lot of problems with Canseco. And look, Canseco threw out the number 70%, and so did Ken Caminiti. But look I think those numbers are way too high, and I look at it like this. People that smoke a lot of weed tend to hang out with other people that smoke a lot of weed. Thus, their opinions of percentages are a bit distorted. So I don't know what the number is either. There's no way that we're ever going to find out for sure. It was over 7% that triggered the testing in the first place in 2003. I think to assume assume that it was only 7% throughout the course of, from, you know, 88 to 2003, that it never exceeded 7%, seems like an ignorant statement. But you mentioned distortion, and to me, the history of the game, which is so important, is being distorted. It's being distorted by excluding a generation of players from the Hall of Fame. To me, what seems to be the more logical thing to do is, rather than just saying this never happened, we're going to pretend it never happened, is to acknowledge that Mark McGwire used PEDs and put him in the Hall of Fame. Because we don't know. There is no way for us to know how many home runs Mark McGwire would have hit had he never used steroids.
But I think he knows. And that's, let's go back to, I agree with everything you said to this point, except, you know, I've written this that I advocate. If you're going to put them in on that basis, then we simply have a disclaimer. Either we have a general disclaimer at that section, because we can do, you know, they go in terms of chronologically. They go in chronologically. So it's very, very easy without any disruption to the actual physical nature of the hall to identify a rough year. Let's say for the sake of argument, 1985, 1980, whatever you want to pick. Say 1980, I don't care. I don't think you have to go back too much farther than that, though. And say, okay, from 1980 to roughly a period of time, and we'll just say for the sake of argument, once again, 2005 or 2000 or whatever you want to say, there was a period of time when baseball was rampant with use of performance-enhancing drugs. All the and suspicions were widespread about many people, including some of the people you were about to find here so enshrined, and some people, frankly, more suspicious than others. But you can draw your own conclusions. If they would do something like that, Ross, I would be – I'd let them all in. If the hall would be willing to do that, then let them all in. That's fine. Until that point, I haven't yet reached. Now, I keep saying this. I may wake up one day and say it is futile. Juice pitchers pitch against juice hitters. I don't know how many home runs McGwire hit that would have been on the warning track, or Bonds. I don't know how many strikeouts Clemens got in 2001 that he wouldn't have gotten if he couldn't still throw 94 instead of 88 because he got juiced up. I don't know these things. It's futile to try to ascertain these things. We got to put them all in. Someday I reach that point, but right now I haven't reached that point.
And in fairness, you are, and I've heard you talk about this and I've seen you write about this, that you are going into this objectively year by year. You are not one of the baseball writers that has taken a vow to never vote against someone never vote for someone that's been associated with PEDs. You have not gone that far. And I think that people who go that far are telling you that they have no objectivity. And objectivity seems to be a crucial part into the people you would want to have voting for the Hall of Fame.
See, they would argue that it's not a matter of objectivity, but of standards. That they would argue that. Just say, would you agree? They would phrase it differently. They would say, it's not objectivity. I'm very objective, they would say. I have standards. But that's what they would say.
Here's the problem with that, Bob. You mentioned amphetamines and the use of amphetamines earlier, which were very common in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and the 80s. They've been common for 40 years, a lot more common than steroids have been common. I don't see the difference ethically. Now, if you're taking something, if you're taking a drug, an illegal drug or a drug that is only available via prescription, and if you're taking that illegally or against the cause of prescription, if you're taking it whether it's to build muscle mass, recover from injury, or to gain energy, it seems like you're doing the exact same thing. While the results may be different, the ethical intent behind it is the same.
The problem immediately here is that unlike this discussion that we have about who may or may not have done roids, there's some evidence. Some people may dispute how good the evidence is, but there's and the evidence can be in the form of you know, word of mouth. I saw this guy do it, or logical conclusions about performance that make no sense otherwise, and things like that. But this, or enlarging head size in case of a certain player who hit a lot of home runs and stuff like that. No, seriously, okay. There's evidence, but the whole Greeny thing is, except for personal anecdote, some certain people that have, you know, that talked about it directly. There's no way to connect all the people to it. There's no way to connect anybody to it. There's just not. And number one, that's number one. There's no way to connect anybody specifically who hasn't copped to it. And I was having a discussion with someone about this recently, and he said, don't ever tell Hank Aaron he took Greenies. Well, maybe Hank Aaron is one of the guys, of the superstars that was here, who didn't take Greenies. But we know that, you know, we strongly just feel that we're led to believe that many others did equally.
He said he took it once.
I don't know that. Okay, well, I'm just now. That's number one. Number two, the advantage of Greenies, as I understand it, it just makes you, enables you to show up, you know, and be alert and get through the grind of 162-game season. Unlike the value of steroids, I may be ill-educated. I'd be happy to be learn to be educated. But even if I were so educated, that wouldn't eliminate the first problem I just spoke to, which is linking them to specific people in a way that we have an opportunity to link them to specific people in the roids not possible. Now, what a convoluted thing we have to do here because of these drugs.
It's awful. It's definitely created a bad situation, and I think anyone on either side of the argument certainly can acknowledge that. This is also horrible for baseball. As a baseball fan, as someone that has always loved sports myself, and sports have always been a part of my life, even though I was terrible at playing them, I've always watched them, and I've always been fascinated by the numbers, and baseball in particular, and Bob, I know you're the exact same way. This is all bad for baseball. Every year, and now this year in particular, that we're going to have a Hall of Fame where Bonds and Clemens, who are two of the best players of all time, aren't going to get in. And we're going to have this argument for another 15 years. When does it get resolved? Are we going to be mentioning this? A-Rod's playing for 6 more years. Is he going to get in 30 years?
As to whether it's better to put them in blindly and unilaterally, knowing if in your heart of hearts that you're putting in some people who did some very dastardly things, as opposed to having this conversation, I'm not sure which one is worse. I mean, if you care about the game, then I think, and I do deeply, then I argue that it's worse to knowingly put them in than to have to subject ourselves to an endless discussions until, you know, certain of the principles. I'm telling you right now, if the principles fess up, it would be different. You know, if Rose had fessed up years ago, he'd be in the Hall of Fame, but he didn't. And on that matter, has nothing to do with this. That's his matter, entirely different. Bonds throwing himself in the mercy of the court with, by the way, Bonds might see, my feeling on Bonds is he's going to get like 55, 60, 70% of the vote. No, 70 is a lot. 55, 50. I think a lot of people are going to vote for Bonds. I think a lot of people are going to vote for Roger. I think that's going to be a very good 50-50 split.
See, I think they're both going to come in around 35%.
No, I think Roger's going to come in 50. Just based on the early returns of what you hear from people coming out of the Roger thing, we'll see. We'll see. But we'll see. I just don't know that that's any. I'd rather have this discussion than give this guy the satisfaction of getting in when he's so arrogant and he's going to thumb his nose and he beat the system. Well, we're the system, and he's not going to beat me for a while. I'll tell you right now.
That bothers me to no end because I find the concept of baseball writers punishing players to be appalling. I think it's a grotesque thing that baseball writers think they have a moral authority over anyone. And if you want an example as to why this is a case, look no further than Bill Conlon.
No, but come on now. That is so ridiculous to say that to draw any link there between the absolute personal foibles. It's not about a moral thing. It's about you have a certain feeling and vision and experience and standard for this game, and you've got this opportunity to reward people, deserving people, with inclusion into the most important Hall of Fame that there is. I don't think that's exercising a moral authority. I think it's exercising a common sense judgment as to about behavior that they exhibit in order to present themselves for your perusal. That's all. And the link, a guy, one deviant person in a subsegment, you know, a subsegment of a society, and who happened to do certain things for a living. No, that's irrelevant. I mean,
right. That doesn't reflect that.
No,
I mean, Bob,
difference.
You're looking at it different. You're looking at it from, you don't know how much the performance-enhancing drugs affected performance. That's you're holding it against them. But many people are not looking at it with that nature. They're looking at it like, these guys did something wrong, thus I am going to punish them. And I think the concept of punishing a player, look, the Rose thing, whether you agree Rose should be in the Hall of Fame or not, the punishment is coming from the right place. It's coming from Major League Baseball. These guys are on the ballot. They are eligible to be elected. There were people who screamed when Mark McGwire became the hitting coach. If you're not voting him for the Hall of Fame and you don't think he should be allowed to be a hitting coach, you essentially think he should be banned for life.
Well, I think he ought to be. Yeah, well, count me in on that. And I don't think he should be a hitting coach. I don't think he should be employed by baseball. I think that's a thumb in the Cardinals are thumbing their nose at the world there. And, you know, his tepid – you know, his, oh my God, no, he shouldn't be. No, I'm sorry. And I don't think, I'm not going to back down on that. You know, I'm waiting here someday to, you know, we get the right contrition. We'll talk about it. But right now we haven't had the right contrition from him.
Well, no one's been contrite because the hysteria involving PEDs and in the Hall of Fame and the way that steroids have been covered, you hear all the time people compare steroid users to rapists and murderers and crooked cops. They're not that. They're just athletes that took steroids. They're athletes that have sought an advantage, which has been going around since the first Olympics.
Have you read the Sports Illustrated piece on the four guys in the twin system?
Yes, I did.
And did that remotely affect your viewpoint on how you would look at users? One of the great lessons of the Mitchell report, it wasn't that we learned anything that we didn't, you know, suspect about Roger or anybody. It was the fact that the by far the biggest ramification of the steroid era was not who's going to get in the Hall of Fame and what records are, may not be broken, but all the guys that did it just to get a job, just to stay employed, just to make it to the big leagues, and where other guys didn't do it and paid the price for not doing it by never making it, while these guys made it, however briefly or however ineffectively. And here's the story of the four guys, and the one guy, Naughty, did it. Naughty did it. Naughty, he did it, and he made it, and he got a ring from the Yankees in '88. And those other guys didn't do it, and they are. They're just beside themselves because they were not being playing the same. There was no fairness there whatsoever. That didn't affect you, and you don't think that affected me a lot. That made me realize that there's no reason for me to give in yet to this whole nonsense that we should let these guys just blankly let these guys in.
The article you're talking about was Tom Verducci's piece in the 10-year anniversary of the Sports Illustrated's first cover story. So
on
it's the 10-year anniversary of that.
Yeah,
that's right. It's the Caminiti cover story. It was the 10-year anniversary. It was Verducci's piece. Now, I will say this about Tom Verducci. I don't necessarily agree with a lot of Tom Verducci's opinions, but he is an excellent writer. So when you have a way to put words that he does, and when you have a way with words, that automatically enhances his case because you're reading this, you're like, wow, this is really compelling. Regardless if you agree with it, it's compelling. I think some of the effects there may have perhaps been overstated, that he was trying to make the pitcher who ended up using steroids sound a lot better than he was. Yes, he got a ring as a journeyman reliever on the Yankees, but this is part of the problem. Journeyman relievers use steroids, and Hall of Famers use steroids. Everything in between use steroids, including guys that never made the majors. I think that to just say, blanketly say, you can't acknowledge that these guys were great, to me it's like what the NCAA does. Bob, did you know UMass didn't make the Final Four?
I talk about this every year at the Final Four. You look in the book and you see the list of the vacateds, and there's a lot more than people realize. And I said,
it's embarrassing.
You tell that to the UMass fans who went to the Final Four. You tell it.
Right.
I know that. That's different. That's the NCAA. That's got nothing to do with this. That's an error. I totally agree with that. Yes, I agree with you.
Yeah, I mean, the NCAA has many faults. Many faults. It ignores. Do you know Reggie Bush simply never won the Heisman? Look at who won that year. You know who won? No one. That Fab Five team with Chris Webber and Jalen Rose, they never made the finals. The distortion of history there is ridiculous, even though people sat there and remembered it. I think for me, when I look at players that used PEDs or steroids in particular, as I think that HGH is unfairly thrown into here with people that don't have any medical background or really know what HGH does. But anyway, I look at Barry Bonds or Roger Clemens, people who I think use steroids, regardless of whatever court decisions have come recently. I look at them and say steroid use is part of their legacy. It is not all of their legacy. I would vote both of them into the Hall of Fame. I would just acknowledge that they both have been suspected of using. You go to museums now, and museums are no longer just big buildings where you go to look at old stuff. There are interactive elements to museums. You go to an art museum, and you hit a button on your phone, on your iPhone, on your iPad, and it tells you about the painting. I think that the Hall of Fame should be doing that with every player. And you can hit it on Babe Ruth, and it can tell you about Babe Ruth. And it can you hit on Roger Hornsby, and you can mention that the good and the bad about Hornsby on the field and off. Same thing with someone like Kirby Puckett. And for guys with steroids, it does the same thing. You can put it on their plaque, have an interactive element, put it on their website. That these structures aren't in place by the Hall is the Hall of Fame's fault. But it's still part of their legacy, not all of their legacy.
I already said long ago, not too long ago, that I propose color-coded plaques, something to acknowledge, if you're going to put them in, something to acknowledge that their taint or their complicity or their association—that's the word—with this situation. And I would be in favor of some having a nice discussion and figuring out some reasonable way of acknowledging that and as a way of, so we don't have to have this discussion anymore. I agree with you. And there doesn't seem to be a lot of sentiment for that, from what I gather. That's too bad, because that would make me happy. I don't know about anybody else. There's always going to be some diehards that'll never be made happy, and I understand that. But I would be willing to go along with that and acknowledge it, some kind of acknowledgement as a way of trying to solve this problem. Absolutely. But to think that it didn't matter—that's what bothers me—is with any suggestion, you know, that when you can't tell the difference, you can't see when McGuire started juicing, and you can't see when Bond started juicing. Not everybody, capital E, did it. A lot of people did it, and that suddenly gets transferred into everybody. Well, no, it wasn't everybody. It's never everybody, no matter what the – that's always a very convenient generic word. It's never everybody. It's a lot of people, way too many, I agree.
And that's the thing. I look at them, Bob, and I say, I think steroids helped Mark McGuire hit more home runs. How many? We have no idea. But I don't think steroids or HGH just helped people recover from injuries. I think it helped their performance. Otherwise, they wouldn't have used them. To what degrees it helped their performance, we don't know. And this is part of the problem. Too much of the voting is on what we don't know and not on what we do know. We know that Barry Bonds, for a single season, hit 73 home runs. We know for his career he hit 762. To what degree PEDs helped him achieve that, we don't know. He may know, but we have no idea. Instead of voting on what we don't know, why don't we vote on what we do?
Well, yeah, but except that there's a big yeah but, as you know. The problem is there's a big yeah but. There's a big yeah but with him, and there's a big yeah but with McGuire, and there's a big yeah but with Sosa. Clearly, there's a big yeah with Nolan Arblanglais Sosa. There's a big yeah but with I'm not here to talk about the past McGuire. There's a big yeah but with Mr. Luggage Head with his size 9.5 head that used to be a 7.5. There's a big yeah but with Roger suddenly throwing 94 when he should be throwing 88. Yeah, and it's right now, I can't sanction it. I can't sanction it. I just can't right now. I might. I keep watching you identify me properly. I'm not closing the door. I'm simply saying that I could. And one good thing is that they all have a 15-year window, and McGuire's is down to 10, but it's just opening up for Barry and Michael and Roger. And remember that the voting body is going to change dramatically, and the percentage of voters is that all the old farts are going to die off, and they're going to be replaced by people who have vastly different viewpoint. Many of them sound very similar to yours, and they may very well constitute enough of a plurality to get these people in due time. But meanwhile, that's the process. I'm comfortable with it. But I'll have the price. I may wake up one day and say, as I said, it's futile. All right, I give up, but I'm not ready to go there yet.
Well, let me ask you this way. What percentage of you doubts Barry Bonds would have been a Hall of Famer if he never used?
Oh, he was already – the numbers were there. The numbers were going well on his way. I mean, there's no question he's going to be in the Hall of Fame if he doesn't use them. He's going to – if you find a date that you want to settle on and then the spiking, you know, and then nobody improves like that in the late 30s. It's never been done in history, and all of a sudden it does to him to an extent that's unimaginable. You know, I mean, this is just so logical. It's not even worth discussing, really. So and not to mention the anecdotal evidence, not to mention the book, The Shadow Against Game of Shadows, not to mention the trainer that whatever is the hold he has on that trainer that could you know, solve all this problem for us. You know, whatever that is, he's got, thank God for him that he's got this hold on this guy, that this guy will go to the mattress for him in a way that you wouldn't do for your own kid. So don't ask me what that's all about. So, yeah, I really, but yes, he was on his way to the Hall of Fame. Roger was on his way, but not quite there. He had 192 wins. He had the three size, but size are modern measuring stick. Old guys didn't have size to put on their mantle. So he probably would have gotten there, but I don't think he would have had 354 wins, and he certainly wouldn't have had the strikeouts and the post-career success, the post-Red Sox success that he had.
Bob, the three best players who have been associated with steroid use are Bonds, A-Rod, and Clemens. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, off the top of my head, I'd say that.
Those three players also each have reputations for being jerks, for being rude to the media, for being rude to their teammates, for being obnoxious, for being douchey. Do you think that those elements come into play just as much as the steroid use?
I must object to that characterization. There is Bonds stands apart. Roger with us, we had up and down, mostly up. Roger was up with the Yankees. Were you kidding me? That's no problem with Roger. That's not going to keep Roger out. We feel Roger is maybe not too smart. That's different. He's not evil. He's not. He's. I think everything he did out of desperate love for the competition and the sport that he truly loves. I don't have any problem with that. Bonds is the evil. You know, he's a despicable human being. That's no question about that. And then you're talking about A-Rod? When's he never had trouble with the media? He's fine with the media. He wants to be loved. He got mocked more than anything else for trying to be too compliant.
He's disingenuous,
yes, but not rude. So no, don't lump those three together. Bonds is the one utterly complete and separate category, and the other two guys really have no media problems.
And you think that's fair?
Well, you know what? Steve Carlton got in. No problem, did he? He got in. No problem. And I don't have to go over that history, so that post-1972 history, which, by the way, all started with Conlon. It just so happens. And that's the guy he was most upset with, who felt turned on him. And he got in. No, Bonds, it's a contributing factor to the point where, you know, you if you're going to be that arrogant, it's not, you know, you may pay a little price. No, I don't think that's it. It's not that. It's simply that people are just using their.
Bob, what about what is grossly unfair? At least with Bonds, there was a federal investigation. There was the Balco book. With Clemens, there was a federal investigation and eyewitness testimony. With Jeff Bagwell, what do you have?
I voted for him. I will vote for him. We got nothing. We got nothing but what some people think is the eye test. Some people say, well, he only had six home runs in Bristol. And well, guess what? Bristol's an airport, and then he went and played in the Astrodome, which is another airport. But there's nothing to tie him. How about Piazza? Piazza's coming up. There are plenty of people that
same thing.
But there's nothing to hang on him other than a suspicion. I'm glad you brought him up. This shows you how frustrating it is to be a voter. How utterly frustrating that we have to make these choices. So you say, well, you don't have to make a choice. Just put them in. And, you know, that's the problem. I can't do that. But, I mean, so far, I voted for Bagwell. Yes, I did. And I know
you'll vote for Piazza, I imagine?
I think I will vote for Piazza. But it's going to be, you know, just as I vote, you know, you can vote and unvote. But right now I'm voting for him. Yes, I don't have by the shaky standards that we have to use. I fully admit they're shaky standards. Any reason not to vote for Piazza. But I have none not to vote for Bagwell. You know, if evidence surfaces, then fine. We can unvote them. We can vote no some other date.
I want to bring up a name who has not been linked to PEDs, so I'm not saying that, but I want to talk about this name because I think if the baseball writers were voting for in this case, he would not be in the Hall of Fame. Tom Brady. Tom Brady, as you know, Bob Ryan, is one of the best players to ever play football. He's one of the best quarterbacks to ever play. He was a late-round pick, described as out of shape at the time by NFL quarterbacks comparison. Tom Brady transformed his body and from being a six-round pick became one of the best players of all time. His phone number was also found in Greg Anderson's phone book, which would be all the evidence that the baseball writers would need. You talk about Jeff Bagwell being unfair, Mike Piazza being unfair. If the baseball writers were looking at Tom Brady, that would be enough circumstantial evidence to not vote him into the Hall of Fame. And I use myself as a perfect example as someone that has all kinds of numbers because of my job. I promise you that Curt Schilling and Shaquille O'Neal have no idea who I am, but I have their phone numbers, or at least a version, an old version of their phone numbers. Tom Brady was in Greg Anderson's phone for whatever reason, but the fact that he was associated with the biggest steroid dealer in the country and became the best player ever would mean he would not get in the Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yeah, well, probably so. Okay, well, that's the case. That's the case. But he's not a football, baseball player. He's a football player, and that is their issue. You mentioned something. I was going to say something. Oh, let's go outside of team sport. How about Tiger and Dr. Galea? What do you think of that?
It seems like Tiger was using HGH. That's certainly what it seems like.
Yeah, so, you know, but there's no, you know, there's no team there, and there's no, you know, I have a feeling he'll get in the Golf Writers in the Hall of Fame. I know,
it's a mess.
You make good points here, but I mean, what? I'm sticking to I have to put my cards on the table. I care about two sports. The rest is business. You know, I mean, and a happy business. I care about baseball and basketball. Me, Bob Ryan. Football's business, hockey's business. They're all, the rest of them are pleasurable business, but I care about two sports. So whatever football does, you know, I'm not really that interested. The people that choose football as their favorite sport, they have to live with it. There's so much wrong with football. You know, we need 2 hours to go into this.
I totally agree.
All right. Hockey is not anywhere near as hockey's. I could defend hockey. We could fix up hockey easy. You can't fix up football without going so deep. You got to start at Pop Warner, for Christ's sake. But hockey could be fixed up fairly easily, especially since the educational component of hockey is so vastly different than it was back in the days of the six teams, and they all came from Canada, and they were from the farms, and they were uneducated, and any shack was going around, you know, illiterate and all that. No, these days we're so far beyond that. It's not even. So we have to worry about that. So I care about two sports. I'm not going to impassion, you know, so I don't get worked up. Whatever football does, they deserve, as far as I'm concerned.
That's fine. And I look at it like this. I care greatly about baseball, and I care about basketball, and I care about football too, but they're nowhere near to me what baseball is. The associations I have with baseball, I'm still someone that watches baseball just about every night of the week. The associations I have when I was a kid of watching it with my father and getting baseball cards, those are something that I associate with baseball and not the other sports. So those aren't going away either. I care greatly about baseball, and I care greatly about the Baseball Hall of Fame. This is what I'm worried is going to happen to the Hall of Fame. The Baseball Hall of Fame is going to turn into horse racing, and it's going to turn into boxing. Because when you ignore a generation of players, you ignore a generation of fans. Ignoring a generation of fans is not something that anything, any business, any organization can survive.
So we have to abandon our standards. We have to just give in and abandon our standards, because the game has been turned around by these people, but we're just going to let them govern the dialogue now. The drug users, the cheaters are going to determine, they're going to control the dialogue. That's what we're saying now, that they win right away. They win. That's a hard one for me to deal with.
It's simply saying that you're voting for the best players of the generation. And
yeah,
of those players use steroids.
Well, they didn't all do it. We all know that. And, you know, that the word every and all and all this is what's distorting the whole thing here. And there are people who didn't do it. And, I'll give you a litmus test. If you show me, I said this all along, I got very few illusions left in sports, but here's one I'm going to cling to. Greg Maddux. If Greg Maddux did stuff, then why didn't he use better stuff so he could throw better than 787? That's all I'm saying. So if Greg Maddux did not do that, and he's a better pitcher than Roger Clemens, and is a better pitcher than, you know, he's not the best pitcher we saw in our time. The two best pitchers, really, when it comes down to it, were Pedro and Randy. God knows. Yeah. So.
But just using that test, Bob, one of the most vocal people who's been the most outspoken against steroid use, starting when he was playing, is Frank Thomas. And you look at Frank Thomas, who's one of the top 20 hitters of all time, and you look at Thomas and you say, well, that guy must have used. He's been the only player that he was the only player to cooperate with the Mitchell Report. He was the one saying stuff in the 1995 article in the San Diego Tribune. He was the one. But just by that same test, you'd say, well, he must have used. But he didn't.
We also know he was a football player who looked like that when he played football.
That's true.
So it's easy to believe him.
Bob, I know you have to go. I've kept you twice as long as I said I would. I'm going to wrap it up with this last question. What are you accomplishing by keeping them out of the Hall of Fame?
What am I accomplishing? I'm accomplishing that we're trying to enshrine the right people. The right, underline right people. Now, the problem is what my version of right is, and what other people's version of right is, obviously differ. That's understandable, and I accept that. But as a voter, I'm trying to put in the right people, people who earn their way in with as best as we can tell the proper way, and are the better people who have accomplished the standards that you want to put in the Hall of Fame. You're trying to do that. If it's futile, I'll repeat it again. If this turns out, and if I finally come to the conclusion that it is a futile effort, then okay, fine, I'll change my mind. But I'm not there yet. That's all. I'm not there. Well, I'm going to give in and say it's a futile effort, that we have to just put all these people in, the juice pitchers against the juice hitters and all that stuff. And we have to. But meanwhile, if I'm trying to maintain it, a proper standard for the most important Hall of Fame. That's what I'm trying to accomplish.
You've been listening to Bob Ryan. Bob is a longtime columnist for the Boston Globe. He's been honored by the Basketball Hall of Fame, and as you've heard, is a voting member for both the Basketball and Baseball Halls. Bob, thanks so much for being the guinea pig and being the first guest on the Replacement Level podcast.
Okay, now I got to wipe the sweatbands off my forehead, Russ. I'll see you.
All right. Thanks to Bob Ryan right there. Bob Ryan, one of the all-time great sports radio or podcast guests. If you're wondering how a schmuck like me gets Bob Ryan on, I've known Bob for about a decade from my days working as a sports radio producer. So many thanks to Bob for helping me out yet again. He's helped me out many times in the past professionally, and this time he just did me a favor. So can't thank Bob enough for joining me today on the podcast, especially considering he was the guinea pig and had no idea what he was getting into. So this podcast is going to be a lot of Hall of Fame talk, a lot of PED talk. We'll get some athletes on as well. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. If you did enjoy it, please go on iTunes and rate the podcast, give it a rating, or leave a comment. Both would be greatly appreciated. Also, if you're interested in acting or in screenwriting, I host another podcast called Conversations with Ross. I have actors on. We talk about breaking in, bombing on stage, bad auditions. If you're interested in how screenwriting works or how to break in and get a screenwriting job, you might be interested in these podcasts as well. You can find those on rosscarey.com and also on iTunes. On iTunes, search for Conversations with Ross. Thanks again for listening to this episode, the debut episode of the Replacement Level Podcast. I do want to thank a few people before I wrap it up. I want to thank my friend Zach Milliken. Zach is a graphics designer who helped me get both of my websites, rosscarey.com and replacementlevelpodcast.com, up and running, and he continues to help with some of the day-to-day maintenance and overall look and feel of the site. So if you're interested in graphics design or web design, you're looking for someone to follow on Twitter, you can give Zach a follow at ZachDM, Z-A-C-K-D-M, and you can check out his websites, paintedx.com and designtypes.tv. Also want to thank two bands for letting me use their music. Thanks to Baker for letting me use their song Reputation as the opening theme, and thanks to Scamper for letting me use their song Barcelona, which is playing right now. You can find out more information on both of those bands on MySpace Music. Thanks again for listening to the debut episode of the Replacement Level Podcast. Hope you enjoyed it. I'll have a new one up soon.